It's the weekend, and you have financial questions that need answering. That can only mean one thing. It's time for Jill on Money, the show that takes the mystery out of your finances. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
Welcome to Jill on Money. It's Labor Day weekend. Where does the time go, Mark? This summer flew by. I know it's still summer. And in fact, if you are like I am, which is you live in the Northeast and you like the beach, September is actually my favorite month. It's fantastic. You know, it's weird. This time of year is off. Also, we always talk about hurricanes. And then we have this terrible hurricane in the Gulf Coast. And I hate to use this as an opportunity to get on my soapbox a little bit, but I just have to very quickly remind people that, you know, when you are in a place that can be subject to flooding, you would be very, very smart to check out what your homeowner's policy covers. And here's why. When you have a flood and you have damage to your home, only certain parts of standard policies cover damage. In other words, a tree falls through your roof, rain pours in, yes, that's covered. Tree falls through your car, same thing, covered. But when you have rising water, water is pouring in through your basement to your first floor, and the first floor is trashed, rising water damage is not covered in most standard homeowners insurance policies. And what people who go through floods realize very quickly, Katrina, Sandy, Ike, and now Harvey, is that you've got to live in a designated flood zone to be eligible to purchase insurance through the federal government's National Flood Insurance Program. And if you're in that flood zone, remember, you have to actually buy it. I remember in Sandy, we were getting calls from people who said, oh, I let my flood insurance lapse. By the way, flood insurance is incredibly cheap through the national program. It's expensive elsewhere. But so you have to be in a flood zone, designated flood zone, then you have to actually buy the insurance and not let it lapse, and then you are covered. So if not, for many of these people, I think they're talking about early estimates, $40, $50 billion just for rebuilding. A lot of those people are not going to be covered, and they are going to have to turn to the federal government for help. So I just put that out there as a reminder. Can you just look at your homeowner's policy? And if you live in a flood zone that's designated as a flood zone, please buy flood insurance. Okay, now let's start the show. I'm sorry. I just had to do that quickly, Mark. There's a little CFP hat wearing going on right there. So our show is called Jill on Money. And if you'd like to get on the air, 855-411-JILL, send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Let's talk to Donna. She is on the line from New York. Hello, Donna. Welcome to the program. How can I help you?
Hi, Jill. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. I read your column every Sunday in my paper.
Nice.
I have a question.
Okay. Let's go for it.
My husband is 63. I'm 60. And he's going to retire at 66. I'm probably going to retire around 63 or 65.
Okay.
We both have 401ks. We put in the max into the 401k. Well, my husband puts in 24,000. I put in 18.
Why don't you do the 24 also?
I don't know. I'm leery of that.
Okay.
But this is my question. So anyway, he's got also has a Roth IRA with about $40,000 in it.
Mm-hmm.
Should I take the to get up to $24,000? Should I put that money into a Roth? Mm-hmm. I don't have a Roth. Or mm-hmm. should I just keep on putting it into my 401k and do the max?
So, how much do you earn approximately right now, Donna?
Me?
Yeah.
Like 70,000.
Okay. And your husband, how much does he earn?
A little more than that. So I would say 80.
Okay. And how much have you guys saved already in the 401? Let's total them up together about how much is in the two 401k accounts.
And everything that we have is $500,000.
Okay. Any pensions that you'll be entitled
to? No.
I know.
Why didn't my mother tell me?
I know. Why didn't my mother? Your mother told you, could you marry someone wealthy? She should have said, could you marry someone with a pension? And you own your home right now?
Yes.
And is there a mortgage that's outstanding?
Very little.
Okay. How much is the house worth approximately?
Probably like $450,000.
Okay. Kids, grown, happy?
Grown.
Good. Thank God. And how much do you guys spend a year? Or what do you think you need to live on?
Oh, I don't even know. I don't
know. Oh, I'm going to give you homework. Do me a favor. Just a little homework. Your homework is to figure out how much money you think you'd need in retirement. And
right.
The way you do that is you look at what you're spending today.
Because right.
Presumably, if you're making about 100...
Once before with a financial advisor, a fee-based, that was my second question.
Yeah.
And he said that we were on the right track to live, to have enough money to
okay.
like 90, but I'm not, you know.
All right. Okay, 90. That's good. You know what? You know, we always want to make the bargain. Like, all right, I'll take 88, but I got to have my brains. Okay. Here's what I think. In terms of your specific question, if you are disciplined enough just to get some money into a Roth, I think it's nice to have some money that's already that's not subject to taxation.
Right.
Okay. So that's the benefit of the Roth. So if you say to me, yeah, should I put the $6,000 a year that I would have put in my 401k into a Roth? Sure. Why not? I mean, I think that's a fine idea. It also gives you, you know, again, money that's already been taxed. It's easy that, you know, you've got you know how these accounts work already. I think that's a fine idea. I have no okay. problem with it. And, you know, the only reason why I tell people just do the 401k is simply that, like, they're not disciplined enough to capture the money. But it sounds like you guys are.
Oh, I am.
Good. And you like your advisor or not?
Well, there's the problem. He actually was a fee base, and now he went to the percentage portfolio type of thing. Mm-hmm. So we didn't want to go that route. Now we're having a problem finding just a fee base.
Wait a minute. You mean a fee only, just like a fee
only,
flat
yeah.
fee?
Yes, I meant
fee well,
only.
Do you need it?
What?
Do you need someone? I mean, like who? What to manage your Roth or to manage to what?
Yeah, just like he would go in and he would tell us what you know. We'd look at what. Both our 401k options are, and he'd move things around, and we'd go in twice a year.
I got somebody for you. Hang on the line. I'll get more. I have some people in New York who you can pay to do that.
I'm on Long Island.
Perfect. It's all right. I love Long Island also. I will. You know all about the flood thing. I hang on the line, and I'll hook you up with a couple of different people you can at least talk to. My guess is that you've already kind of gone through a plan with somebody. And you're probably on the right track. And, you know, for many people, it may be just as easy for you guys at this point just to kind of be on autopilot. And then, you know, when you're really ready to retire or year before you're ready to retire, go see somebody. But like you said, just to be able to pay someone by the hour to go do a little bit of work here and there, I think that makes sense. So hang on the line. Mark will pick you up. And we'll get you going. But yeah, I'm happy to have Roth money. I love the Roth concept because it's just nice in your retirement. What's really great is to have money that has already been taxed. That's the benefit of it. Donna, hang on. Thanks so much for calling. You're listening to Jill on Money. 855-411-JILL is our phone number. Our email address, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
K, IRAs, refinancing. She covers it all. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. Well, I
started out. You're back with Jill on Money. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. I'm Jill Schlesinger. Mark is running the show. And this is going to be a fascinating conversation. I just got a little snippet from Mark about what the caller is up to. But if you would like to get on the air, give us a holler, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Let's quickly get to Stacy, because I understand, Stacy, you've got a time constraint. Stacy from Philadelphia, welcome to the program. What can I do for you?
Oh, good morning, Jill. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
So we are with time constraint both at work, and I am getting married in a month.
Oh, my
and
God.
And the question for you right now is, do I need a prenup?
Tell me about yourself.
Okay, so I am currently finishing my last year of residency as a physician, and now have the wonderful medical school debt that is following me everywhere I go.
I'm sorry.
But luckily enough, I have no college debt and no credit card debt.
That's
right
good.
Now. My fiancé is not in medicine, so that saved us there as well, and he does not have any college debt either.
Okay, your medical school debt will be how much?
It's about $300,000. Yeah. With interest rate at, I believe it's 7.25% with loans.
Okay, here's my quick question. What is your residency? What is your specialty?
It is endocrinology.
Endocrinology. Okay, so you're going to get a job. How much do endocrinologists make as sort of a general rule of thumb? Well, I won't hold you to it, I promise.
Yeah, so on average, between like 160 and 180 starting out.
That's not as good as like 500 grand for doing boob jobs, lady.
Correct.
Okay, I'm sorry to tell you that that makes my life a little bit more difficult. Okay.
Yeah.
What does fiance do?
So he is in the tech industry. The easiest way to explain it is doing user experience and graphic design.
Cool. So when you when you're married, you'll have a good income, right? He doesn't have debt. Does he have assets?
Just explain assets to me.
Does he have savings?
Yes.
Okay. Does he have money invested in a 401k or an IRA or a Roth IRA?
Yes. So both of us have investments in 401ks with matching from our employers. He has a Roth IRA and has some money in stocks as well.
Okay. Here's a question I have for you, Stacey. Is it possible that you're going to be working at a place that might actually allow you to qualify for the public working loan forgiveness, which is the student loan forgiveness plan? In other words, could you be working for a nonprofit or like a hospital? Or?
Yeah, so that is possible. My first 3 years of internal medicine were with a nonprofit hospital, so that counts towards the 10-year. My current location is not a nonprofit. But there is possibility for me to get back with another facility that would be nonprofit that would qualify. So that would require 7 more years.
7 more years. Okay, but totally worth it, by the way, for 300 Gs.
Excuse me.
Okay. So especially if you're going to say like, oh, you know, even in private practice, you know, if in a hospital-based plan, you'd be making like 140 and maybe in a private practice, you'd be making 185. I would still try to be looking to qualify for the public service loan forgiveness.
Okay.
So now you're getting married in a month, and the question is,
do I need a prenup?
You know, for you, it's not so terrible. I got to tell
Correct.
You, it's not. How does he feel about it?
We are both on board with getting one if we think it's something that would benefit both of us. We both come from divorced parents, and we've seen how financial difficulties can arise from divorce, and we're both very realistic. We understand that one out of every two marriages ends in divorce. So
not yours, I'm sure.
Not ours. But it's something that he also, in addition to his job, he does have two private businesses that he has as well.
Okay. So, well, look, obviously, a prenuptial agreement is like pretty much the most unromantic thing we could be talking about 30 days before you get married. But I want to point out, it could save you a lot of future heartache. So I am one of the people who actually believes in a prenup unless there's like huge pushback. But considering that both of you feel like, hey, why not? Here's what you need to be thinking about. I mean, it's a legal contract, right? It determines how you split up your financial lives in the event that the relationship does not work out. Now, look, the student loans are in your name, okay?
Correct.
So it's not as if he's going to be on the hook for those. But what it might do is it might outline what he brings into this union financially, what you bring into it financially, and then how they would, you know, maybe you would put down on paper like, hey, everything we bring in is ours. right?
Mm-hmm.
And if something bad happened, it's still ours. No one's going after anybody's asset. And the only other thing that you might contemplate is potentially how you guys want to handle the debt. In other words, how do you feel if he says, hey, honey, I like hit it big on one of my investments and I'm going to pay off $100,000 of your medical school debt. That's great. Mm-hmm. But if you broke up, does he want that $100,000 back? So I think that those are the kinds of things that you would ask yourselves. And I think, like I said, because it's quite unequal as you're coming into this marriage, it's the like kind of like a perfect case for why you would do it, right? Because, and again, you're not saying like, I am so offended. I can't believe you would suggest such a thing. If you're both okay with it, it'll be pretty mellow for you guys to go through the process with a qualified attorney who's going to walk you through it. So I think that considering that you're both on board, go and do it, and don't worry about it. And you know what? You can tear it up in 5 years if everything's great and you don't like it, or things have changed and you want to go revisit it. You know, everything's up for a negotiation, right? So that's what marriage is all about. As someone who's been married more than once, okay. So I hope that the wedding goes incredibly well. Enjoy yourself. Don't forget to eat. Remember, the hors d'oeuvres are the best. Don't worry about the main course. And just have an amazing time. And don't, you know, like all the things that people tell you, like you should do this and you should do that.
Yes.
I want to tell you the one thing that no matter what, whoever's doing toasts, because I just went to a wedding of someone who's probably around your age. Let's get the toasts in under like 2 minutes. We do not want rambling toasts. And whoever is giving the toast, do not forget to thank the people who paid for the party. That's a biggie. Yeah. So thanks so much to Stacy's parents and fiance's parents for this great party. It goes a long way, trust me. I just had a little drama at a wedding, okay?
Oh, gosh.
All right. So good luck. Have an amazing time. And give us a holler back and let us know how it goes, okay?
All right. Thanks so much, Jill. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
I love that. That's a great question. You see, Mark, you were all like, this is like a bummer because she's got all that debt. I think she's going to get, if she can work in a, so I mentioned the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. If you want to qualify, you really have to go into the government website, studentaid.ed.gov, okay? And you want to get involved in this program because this program actually might go away under Betsy DeVos. It is such a no-brainer. Mark says no-brainer. So you have to... you got to make qualifying payments. You got to make sure that you're on track to receive forgiveness and you got forms to submit. So go do that. It's one of my favorite things that happened. It just happened about 10 years ago. Okay. It is Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. That is our phone number. Our email address is askjill@jillonmoney.com. And we will be right back.
The cure to your financial problems could be a phone call away. 855-411-JILL is the number to dial. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL, send us an email. askjill@jillonmoney.com. Say, did you pick Tremé as music, bump music after the storm? Did you realize, are you an insensitive blockhead, Mark? Mm-hmm. Mark loved that show, Tremé, which was on HBO, which took place in New Orleans. And was like basically about the rebuilding effort after, and all these characters obviously involved. So, he's insensitive, but he's mine. Got a question here from Jacqueline, who says, I truly appreciate and enjoy listening to your podcast because they are very helpful. Oh, by the way, you can listen to this show if you've missed previous episodes, you can go onto our YouTube channel. Just search Jill Schlesinger. S-C-H-L-E-S-I-N-G-E-R. Just put a C-H in there, you'll find me. You can also check out our podcast, Better Off, on Apple, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, anywhere else you find your favorite podcasts. Okay, let's get back to Jacqueline. As a female in the financial industry, you are a role model to me. That's so nice. I respect the advice you provide. I'm reaching out about my current situation. I know I have a good handle on my current debt, but I'm also ready to begin planning my next moves. I graduated from college in August 2016 with a BS in finance. I've been working at my current position for a year. My net income is $50,000. Total debt from student loans, $34,000. My car loan is $14,000. For the past year, I've been paying a small amount over the requirement because I've been putting a large chunk of my income to build my savings. That's currently at $12,000. Now that I've got that cushion, I want to start putting large payments towards my student loans. I can now begin putting an extra $700 a month towards my debt. That's good. So she's got a Sallie Mae loan, most of it, that's 5.6, a government loan at 4%, some at 3%, some at 2.5%. I'm living with my parents. I'm looking to buy a house within the next 18 to 24 months. How are you going to do that? My question is, out of my loans and financial goals, do you believe this is the order I should begin to pay the large chunks of debt first? Is it realistic to have a goal to buy a house within this time frame? Jacqueline, I think you're going to need to stretch out your time horizon, because I think that what I would do is, if you've got $700 a month right now, I would be putting down every extra one of those $700 on that Sallie Mae loan, because it's 5.6%. And I would get that completely paid off. And then, you know, I could start taking the $700 and maybe potentially starting to pay off the 4% loan and also save for a house. But to save for a house, you're going to have to really put a big chunk of money down. And I don't know if you're really going to be able to do that. I don't know if you should do that. I mean, first of all, you're so young. And, you know, I'm presuming you're in your early 20s. And you've been working at this place for a year. I think you ought to let things evolve a little bit. I would feel more comfortable if before you bought a house, you were down to, you know, simply the $7,000 at 3% and $14,000 at 2.5%. I think that would be like okay. But even then, I'm wondering why the need to buy a house so quickly. You don't know where your life is going to go. I just feel like you need some flexibility. So I would say it's one thing to have a goal that you want to move out and pay, you know, and you'll be paying rent in 18 to 24 months. That I can get on board with. I just don't think it's going to be possible or necessary for you to put the pressure on yourself to buy a house. I'd rather be debt-free than buy a house, put it that way. Okay? She's like in her 20s because she graduated from college in August 2016. So I just, Mark says, too young. Have some fun and also leave yourself options. The problem with buying a house when you're that young, in my mind, is really that you're locked into that place. What if you have an amazing opportunity that's somewhere else? I think it might be worthwhile considering maybe putting that home purchase off a little bit. That's just me. You feel okay about that advice, Mark? I think you do. Yeah, renting is great. Bob writes, he's got $3,000 in savings bonds they had for their kids. They were misplaced. They recently found them. Woohoo! Yay, we're so happy about that. By the way, if you do have EE savings bonds, what would be an excellent thing for you to do is to get onto the government website, treasurydirect.gov, and register those bonds immediately, just in case you have misplaced them. You know, it's much easier. Anyway, Bob says that his son has since graduated, but does have some school debt he's paid this year. How would we handle this? Redeem them, pay the tax that's due, and plop it down on his school loans. I don't think... See, double E bonds, you do get a... you do get a some benefit for using it for college, but I don't know if you get it for redeeming it and paying a loan off. I'm not sure. I mean, I just went on the website. Interest and earnings may be excluded from federal income tax when bonds are used to finance education. So you're going to have to look to see whether or not you can do it to pay off debt. May be able to. I don't know. Anyway, you've got to figure out who owes the tax, whether it's you or your son, because we're not sure. I'm not sure whose name it's all in. But go to treasurydirect.gov. Follow the instructions there. Redeem those bonds. Even if you don't get a tax benefit from doing so, redeem them anyway. You're going to pay off the debt. Help them out. Might as well use it, right? Makes most sense to me. If you've got a financial question, give us a holler. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. AskJill@JillOnMoney.com. We will be back with more of your questions in just a moment.
The cure to your financial problems could be a phone call away. 855-411-JILL is the number to dial. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we would love to hear from you. Our phone number is 855-411-JILL. Our email address is askjill@jillonmoney.com. And we're trying to... clear out the old email bin. So let's start with Lynn, who says that she is disabled, unable to work, and just turned 60 years old. She had a real estate investment trust that was liquidated, and she will receive $20,000. She says, I don't want to spend the money down and have nothing after 12 years. I've asked around and have been told to keep it liquid. I want it to last the rest of my life and ideally give to my three children. If I can come up with an extra $5,000, I could get an annuity that would pay me $111 in a lifetime. I'll take Social Security at 62. Run, don't walk, ladies and gentlemen, from that particular bit of advice. No, no annuity. Yes, you should keep your money liquid. That is absolutely imperative. When you are disabled and unable to work, and it's 2 years before you need to take Social Security, then you really shouldn't be doing much with this money. I can't believe you had a real estate investment trust for any reason, and it doesn't sound like you have a lot of other money, right? Because you don't have the $5,000 that it would take you to get that minimum for the annuity. I would do nothing with this. I wouldn't invest it. This is your emergency reserve, and I think it's incredible that you are very fortunate that nothing bad happened to this money, but I'm not exactly sure why you feel compelled to leave the money to the kids. But I would really be keeping this safe. I know that's boring advice, but there it is. Boring advice is sometimes the best advice. Okay. Scott wrote in. This is interesting. He says that I love your show. I first heard you on the 404, the 404 being the tech pop culture podcast by CNET. The longest running podcast, the longest running podcast on CNET or in history? On CNET, okay. That was funny. Anyway, Scott says, I wanted to reach out and say how great it was to hear some prudent caution in relation to real estate transactions on your show with Stephen Gasque from the National Association of Realtors. I'm an auditor for an insurance company who unfortunately has had to review a lot of hardship letters, mortgage modifications, and other fallout from the 2008-2012 years. I started my career in 2008, so it's been a wild ride, I bet, huh? It kills me to see how quickly we forget about the mistakes of the past sometimes. All that aside, I do have a question. You had a nice dialogue with your guest about the mortgage interest deduction and asked why the government should incentivize home ownership so much, but you didn't bring up the other side of the coin, the exclusion of gains on the sale of a primary residence. I personally feel that the gain exclusion incentivizes speculative home buying and selling. And while there are solid arguments for it, like how some of that gain is comprised of capital improvements while you occupied the house, I think the requirements were a little bit more difficult to satisfy in the past, such as living in the house 5 of the past 7 years instead of 2 of the past 5. If that were the case, it could help prevent reckless speculation and risk taking. Do you think the gain exclusion has contributed significantly to housing speculation? So I think this is a great point, Scott. I'm so glad you brought it up because I should have said something about that as well. Because what happens is because you can exclude $250,000 of your gain, $500,000 if you're married, it can lead to some home flipping type of behavior. I don't know how much. I think the idea of living in the house longer, like extending that requirement, is a brilliant one. I love that idea. I think that when we really start to look deep into ourselves about, you know, using the tax code to encourage better behavior, that's the kind of place where I'd love to see it. So I think that's a fantastic idea. And I'm gonna think about writing about this. I really have had such a tough time in the housing market over the course of these, you know, sort of 10, 15 years, because it was really difficult to be talking about using your head and being sane in the mania. Then it was really important not to get people all freaked out when it looked like the bottom was falling out. But you're right. People have short memories, and we really don't want to see that. We really want to see people act far more responsibly, not just with their homes, but with their entire financial lives. So, Scott, thank you so much for writing in. It's really cool to hear from people who have specific experience and are, you know, kind of enlightening all of us at the same time. So for that, we are grateful. Hey, if you have a financial question, give us a holler. Our phone number here is 855-411-JILL. Our email address is askjill@jillonmoney.com. And you could always follow us on Twitter @JillOnMoney. Don't forget, if you'd like, if you're a 404 listener, use the hashtag Aunt Jill. We love that. I'm going to revive that, Mark. I like that one. I like the old hash. I like being the cool aunt. You know what? I'm going to have to start tweeting more. You're right. I know. He's making fun of me. All right, when we return, more of your questions, and stay tuned next hour. We've got fantastic guest lined up, Bill Cohan. Oh, he is going to get you going here at the Jill on Money Show. We'll be right back. I'm the one that jaded you. You're back with Jill on Money. If you have a financial question, we want to hear from you. Come on. 855-411-JILL. And you can send us an email. askjill@jillonmoney.com. All right. Let me do another email here so I can get... My gosh, Mark, you're just killing me with all of this. Okay. This is too long. I can't do that fast enough. Oh, brother. Okay, Rob writes, with all the talk about how investing in low-cost index funds is better in the long run than standard funds, meaning managed funds with higher fees, what about bonds? Bonds, same thing. Is there a certain type of bond class or fund that is smarter to invest in? I know one can look up star ratings, blah, blah, blah. Where do you start? In addition, specific to a Roth, are there certain types of bond funds that should be avoided for tax purposes? Well, first of all, municipal bonds you want to avoid because those are pay lower interest because there is no tax on the interest of those bonds. All other bonds are available to you. And I think that when you think about a bond fund, there are lots of different types. You can do a general sort of a Vanguard intermediate term bond fund. That's gives you a kind of a nice blend. And that will be corporate bonds. You probably are not going to do, I don't know how old you are, you're probably not going to do government bonds at this moment. But if you go into the Vanguard website or any wherever you're doing your investing inside of your Roth, you want to get sort of a generalized bond exposure. I like the intermediate term, not the longer term, because we're probably entering, I keep saying this, I've only been saying this for 2 years, a rising interest rate environment hasn't exactly happened. But I think it, sort of a plain vanilla bond fund like that, an intermediate term bond fund, will give you an exposure to corporate bonds. And that's probably all you need to start off with. If you have, you'll see junk bonds as a possibility. I would probably avoid those. They're riskier. Okay, so I hope that helps. All right, Jill on Money, stay tuned. We've got Bill Cohan. He's up next. He's just written a book called Why Wall Street Matters, a former critic now turned a bit of a cheerleader. Explains it all. He's up next here on Jill on Money. We'll be right back. What I need, and if I share with